current assignment that's due today, this starts next week. So if you don't have it with you now, there's no marks going off. But if you don't hand it in before next Friday, then you're going to get marks deducted. All right. That's it about the assignments. Today, we're going to look at quantizing the electromagnetic field. First thing we're going to do is just take what you know about quantization, follow your nose, and see that it really, really sucks. Then we're going to do canonical quantization, see that it's slightly better, but still really sucks. And then we're going to do path integrals and see that it's much better. So you actually know why we're doing these path integrals that are kind of hard, but there's really a good reason for it, because it's even worse if you're not doing them. So we probably won't get to path integrals today, but so next week there's no lectures, and then the week after on Tuesday I'll do another lecture, and then Cliff is back on Friday. Okay, so let's see. All right, so we'll start with for electromagnetism, we have the field strength is the gauge invariant quantity, so that's the one that we're going to use to quantize. So if you just do the same thing for a scalar field, then you start with the field, the vector field is your fundamental object. So we should make a mode sum of this thing. So we have this E plus minus are the two polarization vectors. So so for the for a photon in the z direction, it's basically the two directions in the xy plane. So 1 plus I, 1 minus I. Let's see. So we remember that A mu is not actually a Lorentz vector, because it's, so F mu nu is a tensor, but A mu is only a vector up to a divergence. So for some scalar phi, this is it's only a vector up to this, so that's going to be important to keep Lorentz invariants later on. So if you do a Lorentz transformation, you're going to pick up terms like that in general. Right. So we want to introduce some interaction Hamiltonian if we were to do a field theory that has any content to it. So what you would normally expect to write down is something like some number here, I suppose. So just coupling the vector field directly to a current, and it looks like a Lorentz invariant thing to do, so you would normally think that this is fine. So we'll see that this interaction is actually not all that you need, and we're going to need to introduce an interaction that is not Lorentz invariant in order to recover a Lorentz invariant S matrix, which is really the thing that we know has to be Lorentz invariant, right? Because that's the thing that you actually do measurements on. So or to say anything about the S matrix, we're going to first have a provocator, which is so we get the same. This is a 2 point, of course. So we have this expression, and then the same thing with swapping x and y and mu and u. So basically, it's from the time ordering, you get two terms, right? One when this one's first, one when this one is first. So this can be written a lot shorter, well, a little shorter, I suppose. That must not have been the 3/2, because there's two of them. And I guess the square root there is also bullshit. Sorry, what?
The time order when you calculate the propagator, the Feynman propagator. The Feynman propagator, it's the commutator of a x, isn't it? You've sort of written it as the anti-commutator.
Oh, that shouldn't be a commutator. No, it's a time order product.
Okay.
It's not an anti-commutator and a commutator. It's just two operators.
Okay.
And it's the time order, so you have them swapped around as well.
The x minus y, that's just the zero component, right? On your
mm-hmm.
Heaviside function.
Let's say so here. Well, it doesn't, but I guess that should be, doesn't make a sense otherwise.
Okay.
So this pi mu nu here is a projection operator. So in so in the rest frame, so well, rest frame, of course, not much you can do that. I mean, like the frame rate's going on the Z, and basically the easy one. So it's basically just a projection on x and y, and zero on the rest. We don't want to have an expression for this p here. That's not just for photons along the z, but for arbitrary momenta. So that means that it must be covariant under rotations. So the result for that is. So basically, you see that this is the same thing in if you are along the z-axis, and basically it's written in a covariant way. So this is the four rotations. Problem is that you really want this to be a Lorentz invariant thing, but that's not really possible to do because you always have to make reference to the to the direction the photon is moving on. So the way that you can write this in as close to covariant as you can is. Now, basically, for this to be part of the
what is the complex in our definition of prime union?
Oh, it's the plus minus minus plus the other way around.
Okay.
So they're complex conjugates of each other. So here you see that this is basically the what we normally think of as the top part of the propagator, just the one with p squared is still in front of it. So basically, what we have here, the same thing that we've seen before, that those terms here all have a p mu in them. So at the end of the day, if we are going to be coupling this to a conserved current, they're all going to drop out at any interaction vertex. So they're not really problematic. But this term over here will not drop out because the p's are already contracted. So this is an extra piece to the propagator that we normally wouldn't expect to be there. At least in a covariant in a really covariant scheme, it wouldn't be there. So if you just take this interaction that I wrote down there, and you take this propagator, then if you do any calculation for things in the S matrix, you're not going to get a covariant answer because this breaks covariance. So that means that we need another piece in the interaction Hamiltonian that actually will turn the whole thing covariant. So this extra term basically contributes as
expression for pi mu nu is that pi mu nu is supposed to be symmetric. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in the parentheses, in the middle term, it's n mu p nu minus. Is that supposed to be a minus?
Yes. Probably supposed to be a plus. Check. Yeah, it's a plus. I just look at this minus here.
Yeah.
You're right.
I think there's also pi 0 in the middle, some p. I mean, in that term, there's a parenthesis, and there will be some p.
Sorry?
Well, I mean, pi mean you're supposed to be dimensionless. And so you see that term in parenthesis. Momentum. There's a p.
Right, I see what you mean. And so you'd expect here to be something like a p in front of it, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's n dot p.
Sorry, what?
It's n dot p in front, n mu p mu.
So this term is already dimensionless, right? This term as well. So it's only this thing from parentheses. But the n mu, it cannot be contracted, right?
No, I mean a separate term like n.
Oh, separate.
Lambda.
Okay, not mu. Okay. Let's see if I just missed it here. Oh, there's it. P.
Last class we have P0.
So there's a P0 actually.
It was
yeah. Like that.
Sorry, what if you modified again?
Excuse me?
What if just change again or something? Oh, well, that one, okay.
Where?
No, I just miss what you have just erased. Never mind.
So this is basically the extra part to the propagator that we find from basically having to make this pi mu nu covariant expression for it. So if the interaction Hamiltonian, instead of having just this, we add an additional piece called the Coulomb interaction. So you see that this this interaction, since it's an integral over two coordinates, it's not a local interaction. But this is the extra term that's required. So if you do any scattering processes, then if you calculate anything, you'll find that the things that you get from this cancel against the things that you get from this extra interaction. So all your results are going to be Lorentz invariant, but it's so there's no obvious way for you a priori to see that this is the extra interaction that you need. So people figured it out that this works, but it's not a very say clear procedure on how to write down what your theory is and then start doing calculations. You write down your theory first with that interaction over there. You start calculating things. You're like, oh, this doesn't make any sense because we get non-local interactions from the propagator, and you fix it with adding in basically an extra term that solves everything for you. So be nice to have a slightly more general procedure that if you start like this, you're going to end up with an answer that's Lorentz invariant, and that's what canonical quantization is going to do for us.
You need a mediator
for the interaction. I mean, like from a conceptual point of view, like if you end up putting by hand, just what can you use or not? Well, one reason for that is because we have light, right? So we know that we need a long-range mediator for it. So that's what we're trying to model. So if you then just write down a theory that consists just of recurrence and some instantaneous interactions between them. Well, first of all, that's not Lorentz invariant. So we do not introduce this because we want to have an interaction like this, right? We introduce this because if you quantize your vector field and you take the propagator from your vector field, you find out that you get a piece which is basically a non-local interaction if you start to do finite models with it. And this is not it's not what we observe to happen, right? There's no fast and light interactions between electrons, so clearly there must be something that cancels that piece. And a way to do that is by introducing Coulomb interaction like this. But from this point of view, it's all very ad hoc, right? So that there's no good explanation why that should be there. But the reason that we need any particles in between is because it's really the system we try to model. I mean, we know there's light, and we know that we want a quantum theory of it. It has to be obviously relativistic because it's light. So we have to make it Lorentz invariant. And that's basically where this whole sonic dance comes from. It's basically bending over backwards to make everything work again, because it breaks if you just do the neat thing, start quantizing it, and you get something that isn't Lorentz invariant after all. So there is a way to do this that's manifestly Lorentz invariant, and that's what we're going to do next. And that's the canonical quantization, it's called. Still not very pretty, but at least so this same term will come up there, and then you can see where it comes from and why it has to be there if you have a Lorentz invariant theory. And it basically has to do with the gauge invariance of the theory, which means there's a that you have more, you're carrying more variables around than you really need. So the gauge degree of freedom is what's messing things up here. Because if you want to quantize things, you have your field and you have your canonical momentum. And the canonical momentum for A0 doesn't exist. Because basically the equation of motion is still. So if you basically vary the action with A0, you get basically P is zero. Identity. So that means that you can't go to the Hamiltonian from that, because you need to have momentum for all of your variables. So you thought you were quantizing a vector field, and that's why things go wrong. You're not actually quantizing a vector field. You're quantizing a vector field up to this gauge invariant over here. So this procedure is all if you're thinking that you're quantizing a vector field, and that's why you run into trouble, because you're not really quantizing a vector field. But you can't really quantize that thing over there either, because that's not a Lorentz invariant thing. So you can't start from that. So you have to start from your vector field. Does that make sense? Okay.
So wait, I thought, you know, we write down this propagator and we get some Coulomb interaction term. And I thought that was perfectly canceled by the Coulomb interaction term we get when we just write down the interaction Hamiltonian. You know, because the interaction Hamiltonian also shouldn't be covariant, because we've taken time derivatives and we've chosen some special direction. So I thought there was a beautiful cancellation going on. So what's the difference? Like, yeah, what's happening here that isn't just a good cancellation?
So this Coulomb, you're saying this Coulomb interaction is already included in here? Is that what you mean? Because this is a J squared term, right?
Well, I guess that's what I'm wondering. Is that, are we about to see that it's included when we do canonical quantization?
So if you do canonical quantization, then we both this Coulomb interaction and this S-determined propagator will arise naturally.
Okay.
I think if you just do this quantization, you just take it out of the big hat.
Here's your
interaction Hamiltonian, because it does what we want it to.
Okay.
Which is a perfectly fine way of doing physics, because that's how you model things, right? You say, like, this is what we want to model. If we do this, it models it, so that must be what it is, and then now we can do auto calculation in it. So it's a fine procedure. It just looks weird that you have those two pieces that are not covariant, and they cancel each other somewhat miraculously at every level.
I
so,
see.
What you call a beautiful compilation, I call an ugly coincidence. So, a matter of point of view, I guess.
Cancellation.
Okay. So, for canonical quantization, we're going to start off, instead of with Hamiltonian, we're going to start with a Lagrangian. Which we can make manifestly Lorentz invariant. So for a vector field, the thing that we can write down, it's basically use field strength, because that's the Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant quantity. So we can write this for the kinetic term for the gauge field, and then we're gonna basically have some minimally coupled fields. So this is your particles to make up the current, that it has to always couple with a covariant derivative. And that's the only way that it interacts. And there could be some potential for phi and whatnot. That's all. We're not going to be worried about that right now. So basically, we're just going to look at those two terms over here. Mainly, actually, at this one. So So what I just said about the momentum, the problem is that if you want to quantize your vector field, you want to have a canonical momentum to each of the components. So pi zero would be defined as dl dA zero dot. But you can see from the way f mu nu is anti-symmetric in the derivatives, right? So it's d mu A nu minus d nu A mu. So A zero dot will never appear anywhere, because that's basically both components zero. That's automatically zero. So the momentum that you get is equal to zero. And that's basically related to that this gauge degree of freedom is not a real degree of freedom, so it doesn't have a momentum. Let's see. So similarly, the equation of motion that you get for A naught is and this can we can write this basically as so basically the charge is the divergence of electric field, like Coulomb's law. So this is not an evolution equation as such, because there's no time derivatives in this. So this should be read as being a constraint on the initial data. So you have to start with some field that satisfies divergences equal to the charge distribution, and then this will stay true after that. Basically, the idea to now solve to quantize the system is to directly solve the constraint, eliminate A naught that way from the Lagrangian by making it just satisfy this, and then quantize the variables that are left over. So basically, this can be directly solved just. Go to your Jackson, and it'll tell you what to do. So, We should eliminate A naught from everywhere here using this this expression. So we express it in terms of time derivatives of the other components of A. And unfortunately, that's not all the constraints that we have on the system. It's still a constrained system because we still have a freedom to take your vector potential so you can add the gradient of some scalar function to it. So we're still having a constrained system. So the choice that we were making here is basically we're choosing a gauge. Where the divergence of the vector potential is zero. Because we could, in principle, choose any gauge, but this is what the nodes do, so I'm just going to stick with it. So now we basically have the system that we're now quantizing is So we have vector field, some meta fields. We're probably just going to go with one when we get to actually specifying what it is. And we have the constraint. So first thing we're going to have to do is to see how you can quantize a system that has a linear constraint, because that's what we're going to be doing here. And in general, you can't just use your standard procedure, because if you have a set of variables subject to a constraint like this, then if we basically just straightforward say, this standard quantization, what you would normally do with your queues, you define a set of p's with it, and you demand that they commute like this. But if you just multiply this by ci from left, then so you contract it, then this side is zero, because you are just commuting zero with pj. This side is cj, so this can only work if all the c's are zero, which then it's not a constraint system at all. So if you have a constraint on the system, this procedure doesn't work anymore. So in order to quantize this, we're going to define a projection operator. So basically, this projects out anything that's proportional to the constraint. So we're basically looking at the space of queues that satisfy the constraint. So if we then for the computation relations instead, right? Things commute to the constraints, basically. Then, basically, this can be solved in for if you have some Lagrangian of your Qi, by defining the momentum as what you would normally do. That should not be a K. But then project it. So normally, this projection operator would just be a whole bunch of ones, right? So you just use failure action with respect to the time derivative of your field, and that tells you what your momentum is. Now you have to project this onto the subspace of your coordinates that actually satisfy the constraint. So on the things that are your actual degrees of freedom. So this is what we're going to be doing for the constraints that we have in the didactic field. So for us, that means that we have So we must figure out some kind of lambda for it. So basically, so those are basically the three conditions that we had here on lambda for the case of continuous variables. So I'll just be writing down the solution and then showing to you why it is a solution. Right, so this is not particularly readable, but this here is a y, meaning that this derivative is acting on the y coordinate here. So, this is enough to guarantee that this is satisfied. Basically by, integrating by parts. Sorry? Oh, so that's a function that we haven't specified yet. So for any little lambda, 2 is satisfied, and now we're going to use 1 and 3 to find out what it is. So, so we're going to use this this condition, and Does this make sense to our solution? So the claim is that this is a unique solution. I'm just a little confused myself at this moment as to why this works. Yeah, yeah, so that's fine. But so you do the Laplacian on this. So then you have, then that's a delta function, but here you have dy of delta, and here you have dx of delta. So I'm not entirely sure why that cancels. Sorry? No, so you have here you have one derivative with respect to x acting on this, and here's another one in this expression, right? So you have two derivatives with respect to x acting on this. So that should turn into a delta function. And then you have this dy left over. So you have a dy on a delta function here, a dx on a delta function. So the only thing I'm confused about is why it's a dx on one and dy on the other, why that would cancel. Oh, because it's x minus y. Great. Okay, so if you take this function and you put this dx, first add this dx on it, then this thing turns into basically dyi of delta x minus y. So that means that we have d by dx plus d by dy of a function of x minus y. So that turns into zero. That it's a unique solution, I hope you're just going to believe that. I mean, it's a linear differential equation, so we have a solution, so it should be all of them. Right, so now we can use this to quantize theory. Okay. So the canonical momenta Yeah, so the DK A naught term for by integration by parts, you can get rid of that one. So we only get the A dot term here. And we need to impose the computation relations. Okay. So now in order to construct a Hamiltonian, we're going to be explicit about what we make the current out of. So we'll just use and we have the canonical momentum for psi. So we can write down the Hamiltonian as just as usual. All right.
Canonical momentum for psi.
Sorry, where?
You have the canonical momentum for the direct. Yeah, where does the gamma zero come from? Let me just.
DL to D psi dot.
Sorry?
It's DL to D psi dot.
Yeah.
And the psi dot term is.
So that's a gamma naught D naught psi, right? Yeah. So. That's it.
Maybe I'm missing something. I'll just do it myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, basically, the term that it comes from is psi bar gamma naught d naught psi.
Oh, of course.
Right. So.
Thank you. Yeah.
So we now have basically quantized this system, this as a constraint system. And basically, from solving the constraint, we have this Coulomb interaction showing up as an extra piece in the interaction Hamiltonian, which we already encountered in the other way of directly quantizing it in order to keep things covariant. But here it had to come out automatically because we started out with a covariant Lagrangian. And so basically, the fact that the whole thing has to be covariant at the end of the day means that it had to show up somewhere, and it did. So at least that gives us some confidence that the whole procedure makes sense. Sorry?
You go from A0 to A0 to H Coulomb? I mean, I assume H Coulomb is the same one we wrote before with two J's.
Yes, it should be the same thing.
A is expressed as another integral. So J is expressed as an integral.
Right,
five.
So we had set expression. So we solved the constraint for A0, but I'm not sure where this is anymore. Of course, something I erased, all right. Let me see if I can quickly find the original expression.
How much do you need it? It's just it's just the standard, that's the potential. So it's equal to the integral of the density.
Well, because we have set div dot a to 0, so it's just j naught over x minus y, right? So but I'm still going to copy it because I'm going to write it down wrong otherwise. So this is how we first solved A0 when we started doing constraint. And this piece, since we set the divergence of A to 0 from the gauge invariance, we're left over with this. So we put this this expression in there. And that's how you get the Coulomb interaction out. So hopefully the factors work out. I haven't actually checked that. So you can see it's an integral over two factors of j, 1 over x, 1 over y. So it has the correct form at least. If the factors work out right, hopefully they should. So this page I didn't really understand when I was going through it at first. I mean, I don't really know what the point of it is. It says that it's showing that this is indeed describing helicity plus or minus one massless particles. If you guys are interested in it, I'm going to come back to that next week after I had some more time to read it over a couple times. So I don't say something that's too stupid. So basically this is canonical quantization of the electromagnetic field. And as you see, it's like kind of a pain in the ass with substituting variables everywhere and having all kinds of constraints going on. Next thing we're going to do is basically the same thing in path integrals. And with a bit of luck, you're going to be convinced that that means the path integrals are a great idea. And if not too bad, you're still going to have to do them, because everybody does. So we're going to start out with doing path integrals just for quantum mechanics, in case you haven't seen it, so there's no fields yet. So we have some states qt that are eigenfunctions of some operator q, so that basically Q of QT is equal to, let's say Q alpha, I guess. So we want to express matrix elements of the form so in order to do this, we're going to insert basically the unit matrix in here arbitrary number of times. So so we're basically inserting an integral over P and Q of the unit operator in between this and this n times. What we gain by this is, so it's important that every inner product that we have here has a Q on one side and a P on the other side. So that means that if we have functions that are some things that are functions of momenta, like p squared over 2m in your kinetic energy, for instance, you can put them on the right, and then if your potential is a function of q, you can put it on the left, and you can both of them, you can be evaluated. So if you put in your Hamiltonian between everywhere here, you can evaluate it because in general the Hamiltonian is going to be quadratic in p. So having that act on the p side, you're going to just get a Gaussian integral, which you can do, and then what you have left over is some function of x, but so you can get rid of all the p integrals this way. So that's why they alternate between p and q all the time. Okay. So. So do I need to show this, or have you all seen this? That P and Q are just related by Fourier transform. Anybody not happy? Raise your hand. All right, we can take this as a given. Let's see. I think I'll try. So it's just the way I would, not really the way I would normally do it. But. Be a lot easier if I could actually read this handwriting. Yeah, so.
You know how to decide. If you just square it and then integrate over P or Q, then you'll get a delta function, right? You square it by Q.
So you're saying. So the problem is the part with you have a whole bunch of variables here. And, well, the other problem is that I cannot read step one in the notes here. So I'm just like, something that I don't know is equal to this and this and this. So I tried to reconstruct what the something was. But,
okay.
So basically saying this?
I put primes on the, or, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, of course, like integral dp,
yeah.
I suppose. So, since this is a unit operator, this is basically qt q prime t prime. Right? Okay. So, I guess if we integrate, if we just put this in and it works, then it should be fine, right? So this is integral dp of all together. This is an IQP. Sorry?
Would be the time evolution operator in the middle, which would give you delta. So
right, so
t.
It's t.
Oh, we don't need the different t anyway.
Mm.
So we can just do it this way then. Fine with this? Okay. This is good. Yeah, and it would then be minus cube gravity. So, and this is just the Fourier transform for a delta function. Right. So this gives you the delta cube transform. So if you put this in here, then you get the delta function out. So that's the correct expression. You happy with that?
Yeah, I mean, the only reason why I ask is, I mean, when I take a look at Weinberg, you know, they have this kind of like a similar thing, but then he kind of claims that he's using some canonical commutation relation. So I just want to check, but you didn't use that, so I'll read it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll show you, you know, where it is.
So what are you asking about?
Well, because he's saying, you know, it's a form like this. It's claiming that.
Right. So, that's because there's one representation in which you can use, in which you can write the canonical commutation relation, is basically that the canonical commutation relations can also be written as writing it as p equals I d by dq up to a minus sign. Give me that I don't know them by heart. So this is one representation that implements the commutation relations, and so that means that that P is the translation operator for Q, and the Fourier, if you then do a Fourier transform of that, then you get this out. So if you insert a P in between here, the P operator in between here, it acts as D by dQ, and then you can see that both sides of this are the same. Because if you would do a D by dQ on this, you bring down a P.
Should be 1 over square root of 2 pi.
Sorry?
That should be 1 over square root of 2 pi.
Depends on your convention for Fourier pi.
Yes.
I suppose it does.
Right. So some people put a 2 pi in the Fourier transform, the other two put a 2 pi in the inverse. I guess you can figure out place conventions for this. I'm never going to make this through to a reasonable point where it makes sense to you guys before lunch, basically. So maybe it's better if I stop here and work this through to a consistent story for next class. So I'll quickly recap those results here, but won't do any proofs of them then.